When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It's Wednesday, October 28th, and you're tuned into the Cleveland Baseball Talk Podcast. I'm Joe Noga, joined by Paul Hoynes, our Tribe beat writer. Well, Hoynesy, anybody in the Baseball Writers Association of America who voted for Kevin Cash for Manager of the Year is lucky and thanking their stars that the votes only count for games played in the regular season, because last night in Game 6 of the World Series, he pretty much opened himself up to as much criticism as I think you're ever going to see a manager take for one pitching change in a game.
Oh, my goodness. What a move, Joe. I mean, I was sitting there. I was cringing when he made that move. I said, you know, I like Cash. He's a good guy. You know, knew him. You talked to him a lot when he was in Cleveland as a bullpen coach. And I said, I hope this reliever gets through and then replace him with Anderson, who's been terrible in the postseason.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's given up runs in 7 straight appearances. I mean, he was very, very – he was great in the 60-game sprint, great in 2019, but he's been struggling, and it came back to bite him. And one of my boys texted me last night. He couldn't believe Cash made the move. He said he's getting lit up on Twitter.
Just on Twitter.
He's going to have to live with this. The only way you get rid of this is to win a World Series and, you know, to manage a team to take maybe next year's team to the World Series and win it. But moves like that, you know, they stay hooked to you like a barnacle. You don't get rid of those moves.
Well, and what does this do for, let's say, a Blake Snell? Blake Snell could not hide his obvious disappointment with that move when he got to the dugout. As you would expect, he was emotional. He was full Trevor Bauer in the dugout. You know, he could not contain his emotions about being pulled out in that game. And afterwards, he said some things that, you know, maybe you don't say if it's not Game 6 of the World Series. But what does this do to a former Cy Young winner in Tampa. What does this do to his relationship with the Rays? What does this do for, you know, Cash? And if I'm a free agent starting pitcher, I'm not even thinking about going to Tampa Bay. I mean, I'm not going to get out of the fifth inning with this guy, even if I'm showing success. The guy had a two hitter going, and at that point, I just not even give the guy a chance to talk his way out of the move, to not even give Snell a chance to try to convince you, hey, I've got this. That's the part that sort of bugs me. Not the decision to remove him. Because the analytics show third time through and all of that, you've got a sound reason to do it. But there's the emotional side of it. You've got to let the guy. You got to give the guy a chance to talk his way out of it.
Yeah, I don't think Snell should have been surprised, Joe. I mean, if you look at his regular season, he had 11 starts. He never made it. He never pitched 6 full innings. You know, they lifted him every time. And, you know, game 2 of the World Series, the same thing happened. He had 4 scoreless innings, 8 strikeouts. Now he ran into a little more problems than in the fifth inning I think, yeah, in the fifth inning in game two, he gave up a bunch of runs. You know, he gave up four straight base runners. Then they hooked him. But still, I mean, sometimes you got to manage a little bit with your gut, don't you?
Right.
In that situation. I was thinking, does Terry Francona make that move?
I think Terry Francona actually might talk to the pitcher beforehand. I think he might let the guy try to convince him. If Corey Kluber sees Terry Francona coming out to get him in that same situation in, game 3, 4, 5 of the World Series, I think if Corey Kluber gives him a look and starts talking to him, I think Tito talks to him at least. Look, I've got to take you out. No, Skip, I got to stay in. I think that conversation happens. But with Cash, I don't think that happened.
Yeah, I mean, Cash kind of is a disciple of Francona's. I mean, it's just such a, and it is, and like you said, there's the stats are there, the numbers are there. And, I remember when, covering Mike Hargrove when he managed the Indians in the World Series, there was a game early in that run when they were making the postseason every year, and he kind of changed his tactics. Mm-hmm. And from the regular season to the postseason, he left the pitcher out there, I thought, one inning too long, and everybody jumped on him for that, for changing, for letting the postseason kind of change the way you managed. Right. And I always kind of remember that, So I don't know, maybe Cash, didn't want to, just completely, put it in reverse and change his thinking there.
Right. I mean, there's something to be said for if you've done it this way to get you to this point the whole time, then if you change, then you open yourself up to as much criticism. So if he doesn't go, at least go out there to say, I'm going to make this change, then he opens himself up to criticism. Why? Well, normally Kevin Cash would have gone out there after the first base hit in the sixth inning. But I think, like you said, there's a feel situation there. The question that we asked is, did Kevin Cash set the analytics movement in baseball back, by 20 years by doing this? Do other coaches, managers, organizations see what happened in game six and say, well, we're not going to manage games strictly by the numbers anymore? You brought up Dusty Baker. Do old school coaches now, does the pendulum shift back to them? Do they now get more of an opportunity to get managerial positions because of their reliance on gut feelings rather than what the analytics tell them? That's the question we posed to our subtext readers. Let me read through a few of them and I'll get your response to it as well. A couple of guys chimed in. I would have left him in, says a guy from the 407 area code. Dan in University Heights says, taking Blake out is not what cost the Rays the game. The fact that they only scored one run is why they lost. Another reader says, I ride with Snell. Another guy said, Cash seems to prefer a lot of parts in motion. That preference caught up with him. Here's two more, and we'll jump back to Hoynesy here. Cash is a good guy who had a bad night. He's very proud of his stable and got overly confident. Like another inning with a red-hot Snell would have killed them. He should have checked with Snell first, shown a little respect. They may have lost anyways, but he could have given him that chance. We're all human. So that's just some of what the respondents on subtext said. Hoynesy, what do you think? Did Kevin Cash set the analytics movement in baseball back 20 years by this one decision?
Yeah, like Dusty Baker will manage until he's 100 now, Joe. he'll be in demand. Joe, I don't think that's going to change because I don't think the front offices are changing. All the front offices are younger, analytically driven. They all have the same numbers, and they're the guys that pick the manager. So I think in the manager, No, we're thinking of old school managers, Whitey Herzog and Earl Weaver and guys like really kind of, you know, you didn't go into the, when you were the GM, you didn't go in the clubhouse, you know, with those guys. They ran it, they, you know, they ran their own show. And but that's not like that this anymore. You know, you, the manager is really, you know, you are kind of not subservient, but you, you listen to, if you want a manager's job, you listen to the, you're talking to the GM every day, and he's down in your office every day, and his, he's got his analytical guys down there pumping information into you, giving you, you know, reams and reams of stats, and, you know, so, and, you know, they discussing the lineup every day. So, you know, well, it's just, well, that, that won't change. I don't think that changes unless the front office has changed.
We've seen that with Terry Francona, Chris Antonetti, Mike Chernoff. That's the relationship that they have. I mean, how many hours do you think Antonetti spent on the couch in Tito's office? I mean, that, just countless. So you have, it, in order to be successful and win right now, you have to have that relationship. You know, it's not like it was when the GMs just got you the players and stayed out of your way. There's sort of like a symbiosis here where the two sort of feed off of each other. And I think, you know, as far as the Indians go, that's what they have with Tito and Antonetti. So,
yeah. And, you know, the first time, you know, when I started covering the Indians, Gabe Paul and Phil Segge were kind of the front office, and you never saw those guys in the dugout, in the locker room. And it started to change when John Hart and Danny O'Dowd were in the front office. They were in Hargrove's office a lot. They were always talking. They were in the locker room. And then, you know, then it, when Shapiro, and it just escalated, you know, from Shapiro now to Antonetti. And it's that's kind of relationship. And, you know, Tito's obviously pretty much an old school manager, but he's adjusted and right. He's, you know, right. open. He's, you know, more like one of the things I thought Cash said last night was, hey, we're an organization that believes in information. You know, and obviously he does, but sometimes that information will get you into trouble. And I think that's what happened last night.
Well, obviously not information that comes from the pitcher who's in the game right now and who tells you, hey, I've got these guys. Maybe they need to believe in all information if that's the case. One of the readers made a good point there. It wasn't just that you know, that decision to pull Snell that cost the Rays that game. The fact that this was a Rays offense that, you know, it was pretty much an all or nothing offense all year long. They didn't do the little things to advance runners or take advantage when they had runners in scoring position, which they did two or three times. They let the Dodgers off the hook a couple of times last night when they had the ability to go and increase their lead. They didn't knock Gonsolin out early. They sort of, let him wiggle out of runners on base. And if they had come through and scored there, you know, the decision might not have looked as bad as it did.
Yeah, and then, they had a couple chances in the first two innings. And then that Dodger bullpen just, I mean, they just hammered them. They just shut them down. I mean, it was a good job by Dave Roberts. You know, who always gotten his fair share of criticism over the last 4 years, what they've been to the World Series three of the last 4 years, I think.
Right.
And they finally win one. And, but he was on his game last night and he had the horses lined up, what they used 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 relievers basically in that game to win it.
Well, and you knew once they got to that seventh reliever, Urias, there was that's it. He's the hammer. That's like bringing in Aroldis Chapman against the Indians in any playoff series.
And multiple innings. That's what's impressive about Urias is he was a starter during the regular season. I guess they're kind of in and out, but so he's got that ability and that. They really used him well, I thought.
Yeah, he really overwhelmed hitters throughout the series. I no surprise that Corey Seager was the MVP, but if you look, in the games that the Dodgers won, Urias was certainly a valuable piece. You mentioned that the Dodgers were in it three times, or is their third in 4 years. They finally break through and win one. For guys like Corey Seager, like Clayton Kershaw, and we'll get to Justin Turner in a moment here, but you know, this is a group that has been through it the last few years and finally comes through and wins one. Boy, the Indians sure wish that, you know, it worked out where you keep a core group together and they go through a playoff run over a stretch of years and they finally get rewarded with a win. Sure would have been nice for the same thing to happen for the Indians.
Yeah, you know, I got an email from a reader wondering how many Indians are still around from that 216 team, 2016 team. And, I think there's only maybe four or five, Lindor, Ramirez, Perez. There was a couple other guys. I think Adam Plutko made his big league debut that year, but wasn't in there. And Naquin, I think, was in there.
Right.
But you know, that and that, you know, you knew when they got to that point, you know, and didn't win it, that the changes were coming. And that, you know, obviously a team like the Indians is going to turn it over faster than a team like the Dodgers.
Right. And so, yeah, that's sort of what it means, is like how hard it is to sustain –
yeah,
that much success over even a 3-4 year period of time. It like you said, it's easier when the Dodgers have the payroll and the sort of the financial means that they do. But to just be able to be that consistent, I mean, you're talking about with Tito now, what, going into his eighth or ninth year with the Indians. You know, they've gone from, you know, winning in 2013 to, you know, down, losing a couple of seasons, 2014, 15, to up for three seasons and then down for a season. And now, you know, it's sort of this peak and valley sort of thing. That's unusual to be able to get back up to that top level, you know, more than once in a stretch like that.
Yeah. And what the Dodgers have won, you know, 8 straight division titles. You know, so that you're going to get a lot of chances if you win that consistently. The your players are going to. That's why a guy like Seager, who's pretty young, still a young guy, 27, has 10 postseason home runs. Think about that, Joe. I mean, that's crazy that they have that. Right. And that's just not, you know, this year he had what, 8 or 9, 8 this year. But you know, so he's been in a lot of postseason, you know, situations. All those guys are really experienced. I mean, the bulk of that Dodger team, you know, not too much is going to, you know, surprise them. I mean, this year obviously was a lot different, a lot of different circumstances because of the virus, but those guys have a ton of postseason experience, and that goes a long, long way.
Well, speaking of the virus, it was interesting to see the reason why Justin Turner was removed from that game. It turns out that he had a positive coronavirus test, and it was revealed, you know, just in the middle of the game. They actually pulled him in in like the 6th or 7th inning.
He didn't come out for the 8th inning.
Yeah, and that has to be crushing for him not to be able to, you know, celebrate with his teammates in that way. You just won the World Series, and you've got to stay away because of the virus. But he was the first major league player in like the last 50 some days, 54 days to test positive. You know, when the season and the idea of playing this season started, and even the bubble idea for the playoffs, you know, there were still teams that you go back to St. Louis and Miami, there were teams that were getting, you know, crippled by this. But for the most part, Major League Baseball got a handle on the virus and was able to navigate through and complete a season and get it done before the election, which is what their goal was.
Yeah. They were right too. They predicted another spike in the virus around this time. That's why they didn't want to, you know, to get it done as fast as possible so they didn't play a longer regular season. But I think putting the postseason teams, you know, in the bubble, you know, and then moving it to, you know, the neutral sites in San Diego and Texas and Dodger Stadium, I think. Mm-hmm. And so it worked. And, you know, kudos to them. They got this thing done. And hopefully Major League Baseball and all its fans don't have to put up with this again next year. But the thing that surprises me, Joe, is so who sent this email to the Dodgers in the eighth inning? And was Turner playing? You know, how long was Turner playing this whole series?
Well, but you never know when he contracted it. So, I mean, he could have gotten it within the last couple of days. But he was definitely out there playing in the series with the virus.
Yeah. You know,
that's crazy. He's breathing on umpires. It would not surprise me to see a good number of players on either team or umpires or officials at the site, you know, wind up testing positive within the next week or so. Because of interaction with Justin Turner.
Yeah, because he came back out on the field after they thought he was isolated. He came back out on the field. He was in the team picture. He was shaking hands and hugging people. Sometimes he had a mask on. Sometimes he didn't. I mean, you know, that was so, you know, I guess, okay, you know, it's over, you know, finally. But
hey, everybody go get infected now. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
It was strange. It was really, really strange.
But you're right. Hopefully it doesn't happen that this has to, you know, be the case next year. But the chances are right now that you're going to be opening games maybe in April with no fans in the stands anyways. So I can't see the things being returned back to normal by the time Major League Baseball is supposed to get things started again next year. I just don't see it happening.
No, either do I. This thing is just kind of off the charts, and it's spiking again. And, you know, I'm wondering, Joe, is this like college, you know, college basketball or football when there's an ineligible player on the field playing? Do the Dodgers have to forfeit this, or can the Rays protest over Turner being on the field? You know, because obviously he started the game with it, you know, and
right, but he didn't know at the time that he was starting the game with it, so that can't be an issue.
It was like so weird. It was like Major League Baseball at the height of its game, you know, the best moment of the season, still can't get away from COVID.
Right. Does COVID and does this whole situation in a bubble with no fans and shortened season, does that take anything away from the Dodgers winning their first title since 1988?
Not to me, Joe. I think, you know, I thought Chris Antonetti summed this up very, very well at the after the, you know, in the 2020 review of the Indians, when he said, I know we only played 60 games, but it seems like we played 260 games. Mm-hmm. This has been a trial by fire, really. I mean, you just think about what we covered here, Joe. Think about how many stories we've written about, you know, the spring training one, that ends March 12th. Then there's 3.5 months of nothing, you know, just, you know, guys building mounds in their backyard. Then they come back for spring training too. That's like a 3-week, you know, fire drill. And then the season starts. You get through that. The season almost ends when the Marlins and Cardinals have, like, you know, half their teams test positive. They get through that. And then you go through four rounds of postseason play, right? I think. Right. Yeah, I think they've played – Seager, I think the Dodgers may have played 18 or 19 games, postseason games. You know, that's what, 30-35% of the regular season in the postseason. So, you know, I think if you win this thing, you earned it and you deserve it. And the Dodgers obviously did deserve it.
Right. Any team that navigates that whole set of circumstances was going to deserve some sort of recognition. And in the end, the best team in baseball, you know, through the regular season, the Dodgers proved themselves to be the best team in baseball, and you know, they come out on top. So now our focus sort of shifts towards postseason stuff. I guess we're going to have as normal a postseason as we can. We're going to have awards. We're going to have, sort of the hot stove discussions with trade possibilities and all that. And then we'll wait to see if we wind up back in Arizona for spring training come, you know, February and March.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have a winter meetings. Have you heard anything, Joe?
Nothing at all. It's a possibility that the winter meetings take place virtually.
Yeah, wow. Well, yeah. How are they going to work the lobby with that? How do you put a virtual lobby?
They're going to have Scott Boras standing on a staircase with a camera pointed at him and
right.
a Zoom call. That would be
interesting. you know, some bars that are still open till 4 o'clock, 4 a.m. You gotta find a couple of those virtually, I guess.
So wait, Hoynsie, you're saying that a lot of work gets done at these winter meetings at bars? Is that what you're? Is that the message that you're sending here? I don't know about that. I wonder. Also, with the World Series concluding, that means that all the players who are eligible to become free agents now certainly do. The Indians have three players who immediately became free agents this morning: Cesar Hernandez, Sandy Leon, and Oliver Perez. That means the 40-man roster is now at 37 players. There's a slew of Indians minor leaguers who also became free agents today. Probably the only notable one, Luke Wakamatsu, an infielder who actually appeared in a couple of Major League spring training games a few years ago. So not a lot of changes there, but we're expecting a lot more coming soon over the next couple of days. Your information on guys who have contract options.
Yeah, you know, the Indians have Carlos Santana, Roberto Perez, I'm missing somebody,
Brad Hand.
And Brad Hand, yeah. So I think we should find out at least probably by the end of the week if what the Indians' intentions are regarding those options. I would think we've talked about it before, Joe. I don't think there's any – for sure they're not picking up Santana's option, $17.5 million. But I think it's going to be curious if the Roberto Perez $5.5 million option, is it within their reach? That's going to be a big clue to, just how bad off they are financially, how much the pandemic hurt them if they let him become a free agent or they pick that up.
Yeah, my heart tells me that they decline Santana and Hand and that they pick up Perez. But my head tells me right now I think maybe they decline all three. And who knows? You've got Austin Hedges. He was awarded $3 million, or he settled for $3 million before arbitration last year. So you're either locked into $3 million for Hedges or $5.5 for Perez. If they're in a position where that $2.5 million doesn't kill them, I think it's obvious you bring back Perez as the superior catcher. But who knows? If it's as bleak as Chris Antonetti said, the financial picture, then it's going to make an interesting rest of the week. All right, Hoynsie, we're going to wrap it up here and be back again tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday on the Cleveland Baseball Talk podcast, and we'll hopefully have a little more clarity on those contract options.